Okay, I think the recording will work this week. We're back to our standard apparatus. I'm hearing a lot of echo. Is it too loud? Okay. No problems. All right. Before we begin today's discussion of taxation, I wanted to share with you a little bit of data from the last election around the issue of gerrymandering. I'm sure that Joel Rogers covered the general topic and perhaps presented a little bit of information. But since in the last 2 weeks there's been various kinds of data gathering, I think it's worth thinking about the implications for the present of exactly how gerrymandering works. So some of this data may have been presented last time. In the United States as a whole, as you know, for the House of Representatives, we have a Republican majority, reduced from the previous Congress, but still 33 seats. In a representative democracy where the representation is translated from voters' preferences into legislators, if there was a 33-seat majority for Republicans in the House, there should be a majority of people who voted Republican in the election. And a considerable majority. That's a 10% margin in the number of seats they have. But as you can see in the 2012 election, there were 500,000 more people nationally who voted for Democrats for the House of Representatives rather than Republicans. And that's because of the way district boundaries are drawn. This also happened in Wisconsin. We have eight seats in the House of Representatives. Five of them are Republican, three Democrat. And yet 50,000 more people voted for Democrats than for Republicans. One of the worst cases in the US was Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania has 18 seats in the House of Representatives. 13 of them are Republican. But as you can see, there were 80,000 more people who voted for Democrats. Now, the reason that happened in Pennsylvania was because in 2010, when the census was done, the boundaries of districts were redrawn. That's what you do after every census. The Democrats in their districts won by an average of 53 percentage points. That is, the typical Democratic district would have had a vote that would be something like 25% for Republicans and 75% for Democrats. Huge concentration of Democrats in districts that voted Democratic. Whereas the Republicans won their districts by an average of only 18 percentage points. As a typical Republican victory would be 42% versus 58 or 41 versus 59. So if you're gerrymandering districts in favor of your party, what you want to do is to concentrate all the opponents in one district, get them super concentrated, and then you'd like to win all the Republican or whatever your party would be, the districts of your party, by just a modest margin. If you do that, then you get a way disproportionate number of seats, disproportionate relative to your representation in the population. So in Pennsylvania, there's 5 Democratic seats and 13 Republican seats, even though more people in Pennsylvania vote Democratic. And that's true in Wisconsin as well. Now, this is not just a small little detail. We are currently in the United States facing very difficult political choices, as I'm sure most of you know. There's very difficult debates going on inside of Congress now over the question of how to deal with deficits, how to deal with the stagnant economy, how to balance these different kinds of agendas. And one of the things which makes it difficult to resolve these issues is that the House of Representatives is controlled by Republicans and the Senate is controlled by Democrats. But the control of the House by Republicans reflects the success of gerrymandering by state governments in the last census, rather than reflecting the will of the people. When you hear people in leadership in the House of Representatives saying that the people voted for fiscal conservatism, for cuts of Medicare and Social Security as a way of solving the problems of the deficit, when you hear conservatives proclaiming that, pointing to the previous election, it's simply a misrepresentation of what could reasonably be described as the will, that is, the preferences of the people, as registered by their voting choices. At a minimum, the House should be modestly more Democratic than Republican. But as you know, it's more Republican than Democrat. We don't need to go into all this detail. This just shows all the states that made significant gerrymandering changes in 2010. And the crucial cases are the ones in which there's a majority of the vote that's in one party, but a majority of the seats, which is in another party. The implication, it wasn't only just Republicans, of course. There were a couple of states, two states that gerrymandered in the Democratic direction. These are cases in which the majority of votes were Democratic, but there's a way disproportionate share of Democratic seats in their representation in the House. Just to give you an illustration of what that means in Wisconsin, it takes almost two Democratic voters to equal one Republican voter. Every Republican voter has basically 1 3/4 votes with respect to representation in the House of Representatives. That's not as bad as in North Carolina, where every Republican is the equivalent of three Democrats in terms of their ability to have their preferences translated into actual representation. Okay, that's a sad story. Let's now turn to a different topic, which I think is, as I've said a couple of times during this semester, there are some topics which I just think are not just politically important, but they're just really interesting intellectually. So if you can shed your political preferences and your ideologies and just think about the puzzle of taxation, just think of it as an intellectual problem to solve. How in the world are we going to get resources that are controlled by private individuals into the hands of our collective entity, the government? Right? So even the most conservative people who want an absolutely stripped down government still recognize that governments need money, right? There's almost nobody, certainly nobody in any prominent political position who is a literal anarchist. An anarchist says we should just get rid of government altogether. No government. Don't give them a penny. Well, almost nobody actually believes that, even if they say it. They don't really in their hearts believe that the world would be a better place if we simply reduced governments to zero. The most conservative anti-government people in the political scene in the United States simply want a government that does a minimal amount of things, enforces the law, has national defense, police, and a few other very basic but minimum functions. And therefore, the government needs to have resources. And taxation is the way we do it, right? So what I'd like us to think about are a number of issues. First, what is taxation? Let's really try to sort out how to think of this concept of taxation. Then I want to turn to the question of tax fairness. What does it mean for taxes to be fair or unfair? And then to a peculiar problem that's probably in some ways more a problem in the U.S. for various historical reasons than in many other places, and this is the question of tax complexity. is it a good or bad thing that we have a really complex tax code? There's a temptation to say everything would be better if it was simple. Well, that's not always true. Sometimes there is virtue in complexity. Complexity can enable you to accomplish things that a simple code wouldn't. So let's think about complexity as a problem in how we organize a tax system. But first, what are taxes? I want to contrast here two different ways of thinking about the very basic category. Here's the first one. Taxes constitute a system by which the public takes resources away from the private. And the basic kind of image here is that people earn an income through their private economic activity. This income belongs to them. They own it. Taxation is the government taking money away from citizens and using it to pay for government activities. It's a form of taking away. This image has a kind of two-step process. First, income is privately owned, and then through coercion, because the state is using its power, part of your income is taken away from you. In the extreme version of this, taxation is theft, right? That's a slogan. If really it's the case that it's yours and then it's coercively taken away from you, it's kind of like stealing. That's one view. The second view has a whole different kind of perspective. It says this: we collectively engage in economic activity. Nobody earns income on their own. Nobody. It's just impossible. I mean, if you go off into the wilderness of Alaska and live on a small plot of land and hunt in the woods and gather your own food, you could say you earn your own livelihood, your own subsistence on your own. You could do that in isolation from other people. But if you're actually going to earn income, that is money, it's done through interactions with others. And fundamentally, that means you're cooperating in a complex social whole to generate both the products and services that constitute economic activity and the income that's generated from it. It's a collective, cooperative, interdependent activity. So we get together in various ways and interact, produce all the income in the economy, and then we divide it up into public and private shares. That division between public and private shares of the total income we collectively and cooperatively produce, that division is a division between that part of income that's used for our own personal consumption at our own discretion, let's call that private income, and that part of our total income that's used for our common good, that's used to produce public goods and collective consumption. Everyone's standard of living is a combination of what you privately consume and what you consume by virtue of being part of a community with other people, that is your public consumption. Every single person in the United States consumes public goods daily. You consume clean air and clean water. Those are public goods. You consume fire protection and police protection. Those are public goods. You consume national defense. You are all in this room consuming national defense, so to speak. These are all public goods. They have to be paid for. They're paid for out of the total that we've produced in the society. And it's not that anything has been taken away from you to pay for these public goods. It's just that we have decided how to divide the total income into the part allocated to each purpose. In a capitalist economy, which is organized around markets, the easiest way to divide up this total pot into a private and a public portion is through the use of taxation. That's the mechanism by which we make the division. But describing it this way implies that you shouldn't think of it as the income being, in the first instance, yours and then taken away. In the first instance, it's ours because we cooperatively and collectively produced it, and then divide it into what's yours and to what remains in the collective. It's a division of total production into a part to be used for two different kinds of purposes. one which we decide to allocate through our joint decision-making. We call that democracy. And that which we decide to allocate through purely private decisions, we call that personal income. Now, you can see that these different ways of looking at income create a very different moral landscape for worrying about the problem: are taxes too high or too low? If you adopt the first view, the presumption is that as soon as taxes go above what I personally want them to be spent on, they're too high. Right? Because it's really my money. It's being taken away from me. As soon as it's being spent on things that I don't personally approve of, then those taxes are too high. That would be a consequence of this first way of looking at taxes. It's my money. You have no right to it. All right, you can take a little because I agree that that's a good purpose. As soon as more is taken from me than I think is justified, it begins to feel like somebody's stealing it from me. That's the first view. In the second view, what you have is a political process in which we jointly say, let's debate the problem of how much overall we want to spend for our collective consumption, and then let's figure out how to get the resources for that part of our total consumption. And there'll be debates, there'll be different views as to what kinds of public goods we need, what kinds are unnecessary, what's the best mix of different kinds of public goods. Of course, that will not be a simple matter. It will be something done through democratic deliberation. But so long as the process by which our collective use of our resources is decided democratically, then it is justified. I may not like it, but too bad, because I'm part of the collectivity in which we have to make this decision between public and private consumption. There's no presumption, therefore, that the higher levels of taxation constitute something taking away anything from me. It's just a decision about how to allocate resources between these two public and private purposes. One can still have, of course, in the second view, a debate that says, no, these taxes are too high, because the consequences of spending this amount of money on public goods are undesirable. One can argue that it's wasteful, we don't need these public goods, and therefore we're spending too much on them. But equally, we could argue we're spending too much on private consumption. You know, we had this earlier in the semester, we had a discussion about public transportation. If you take this public goods view about consumption and say everybody's consumption consists of private and public consumption, then you could easily argue, indeed I do argue, that we all collectively spend way too much on personal consumption for transportation. It would be a much more efficient and beneficial for the planet, as well as for life in cities, if more resources were devoted to public transportation and less to private transportation. And that would be a collective democratic decision about how do you allocate the resources between public and private, but would not be a discussion about how much we should take from the private. It would just be about dividing between the two. In the United States, needless to say, the first perspective, I would argue, is pretty much the dominant view. You know, most people, I think, just spontaneously experience taxes as a subtraction from what's theirs, rather than a division of the total pie. It's experienced as an alienation, as something that's taken away from them. And this gets reinforced in the political rhetoric around taxation that has dominated American politics over the last several decades. Certainly throughout your lives, it's been the dominant rhetoric of tax politics. You know, you hear politicians saying things like, you know better how to spend your money than does the government. You know how better to spend your money than the government. It's as if the government is spending your money as opposed to the government is spending our money. that kind of rhetoric is a common, constant mantra in American politics and reinforces this rather natural experience that taxation is a subtraction rather than taxation is a division. Which of these two views is correct? You know, I've given you two views. Well, that's not a simple question. There's actually, I think, merit in both views. I adopt the more collective view about taxation and income, that we do this cooperatively and it's a division of the whole into two parts. But that doesn't mean I don't think that there aren't genuine and legitimate arguments for the other perspective, that is, that taxation is taking away. Particularly in a context where, as I've argued in other parts of this course, the process by which the allocation of resources isn't all that democratic, right? You know, in this lecture I've said we collectively, democratically decide how to divide the total pie into private and public uses. Well, that's a kind of gesture because we of the people, don't collectively decide how to do this because our democracy is a weak democracy. It's one thing to say that we're dividing the total pie between public purposes and private purposes if we had a rich and robust democratic society, but we don't. It's a society in which our politics are not governed deeply by democratic principles, only thinly by democratic principles. And once you have a non-democratic society, then the idea that it is they, the government, taking money away from you, has more credibility. And that's why both of these perspectives have some real play, and it's not a simple matter to simply say, yes, one or the other is correct. Still, I think we can ask the question, which of these views, the view that government taxation is subtracting something from your income versus taxation is dividing our collective purposes into what should be done privately and what should be done publicly. We can still ask the question, who benefits from different views of taxation? Which of these views of taxation serves whose interests more? This is the question of tax ideology and how it is connected to class interests. Who really benefits from a particular view of the problem? In whose interest is it to insist that taxation is a form of legalized theft, to kind of exaggerate the issue? Is this way of thinking about taxes more in the interests of the rich and powerful, of ordinary citizens, or of the poor? Which of these views best serves the interests, just the sheer simple economic interests of particular classes of people? Whatever else one might want to say about this question of taxation, I think it is clear that if you are well positioned to be able to acquire a high income from private transactions in the market, if that's the case, then it is in your interest to make very strong claims about your rights to that income and to challenge the general legitimacy of taxes. It's more in the interests of the rich and powerful to view taxation as a subtraction from what's legitimately theirs than it is in the interests of the poor and even of most ordinary citizens. Now, to point this out, to say that a particular view of taxation is more in the interests of one group than another, that doesn't settle the question as to which view is right. Something can be in the interests of the rich and powerful, and it could be the best way of looking at things. It could also provide the most coherent framework, the most powerful philosophical way of thinking about the problem. It doesn't show that the views are wrong, simply to show that they serve the interests of particular groups, but it should make one at least a little skeptical when people make certain kinds of claims that are self-serving. Well, let us assume that taxes are legitimate. I assume most people in this class think that we do need taxes. Whether you have the first or second view that I've laid out here about the nature of taxation, you think that taxes are an important and necessary feature of the society in which we live. The question then is, what's the fairest way to organize a system of taxation? How should we think about fairness with respect to taxation? And then how do we think about complexity? I'm going to focus on income taxes for fairness. There are lots of other kinds of taxation. We have sales taxes. That's not the same as an income tax. We have what are called payroll taxes. Social Security is the best example. That's a tax paid on payrolls, typically in the form of a contribution by both employees and employers. We have taxes on capital gains. Capital gains are the difference between the price of an asset when you purchased it and when you sell it. So if you buy stocks at $1,000 and sell them at $10,000, you have $9,000 of capital gains. That's what that term means. So these are all different kinds of income, and they're taxed in different ways. You have a tax on capital gains, you have taxes on corporate profits, you have taxes on income. I'll focus on income because it's the most straightforward. And the principles of fairness, I think, apply to other mechanisms of taxation as well. Let's just focus on this one for the moment. What does it mean for taxes to be fair? What's the fairest way of having taxes? There are three basic kinds of tax systems on income. One is everybody pays the same amount. That's called a poll tax. The second is everyone pays the same percentage of their income. That's called a flat tax. So if a flat tax typically is pegged at something like 15 or 20% of income. So everybody pays the same percentage. And the third is everyone should have the same tax burden. Not the same tax rate, but the same tax burden, and make the same sacrifice. That's typically referred to as a progressive tax. These are three different ways of thinking about what a fair tax system would be like. What I'd like to do is to just very briefly explain each of these and then open this up for a general discussion. So get your courage up as I talk to enter a discussion on these issues as to what you think really would constitute the fairest basis, the basis that corresponds to your sense of justice and fairness to organize a tax system. But I want to first just explain what each of these mean. So first, everyone pays the same amount. That's a poll tax. It's called a poll tax because there was a time when this was a common tax. In some parts of the world, there would be a tax that would be levied on every household of $100 a year, let's say. And that would be irrespective of any other considerations. Everybody pays the same amount. Very few people support poll taxes today. We have some things that are kind of like poll taxes. Not exactly. But for example, if you live in a world where basically everybody has to drive, you know, that public transportation is sufficiently weak that to get around, nearly everybody has to own a car and drive, and you charge the same registration fee for everybody, that's kind of like a poll tax. You know, it's not literally a poll tax, it's a fee. But if the fee is charged the same for everybody, it's a little bit more like a poll tax. If there were no scholarships available for universities and no Pell Grants, and tuition was just a flat fee, same amount for everybody, that would be kind of like a poll tax for higher education. Certainly if we charged every elementary school student $500 a year to go to elementary school, you begin to think that's not just a fee, that's really pretty close to a poll tax. So fees are the shadow of a poll tax in the present system by which governments get resources, fees for services of various sorts. And the more universal is the service, the more it begins to feel a bit like a poll tax. Still, poll taxes, everybody should pay the same absolute amount, I think very few people think that's a fair way of raising money for the government. A flat tax means everybody pays the same percentage. So you'd have two people, one earns $10,000 a year, the other earns $100,000 a year. It's a simple example. And suppose we have a flat tax of 25%. That means that the poor person pays $2,500 a year in taxes and the rich person pays $25,000. This means that the better off person pays 10 times more than the poor person. And let us suppose, just you know, to make the arithmetic simple, that these two people were the only taxpayers. We live in this very simple society. It has two people, one rich, one poor. This would be a situation in which the rich person would pay over 90% of the taxes used for public goods. And some people would say, that's unfair. The rich shouldn't be paying 90% of the expenses of the government. That came up in the last election. I don't remember the exact figure quoted, but in one debate, Romney made the point, I believe, that the top 10% of taxpayers pay for 60% of all government spending. Made some statement of that order. My figures may be off, but that point was made, suggesting that they're already paying a disproportionate share. If 10% of the people pay for 60% of the government, that sounds like they're paying more than their fair share. Well, that's the flat tax idea. Everybody should pay the same percentage, and even then, some people will pay way, way more than others. That's the flat tax idea. The equal burden idea says you compare the same two people. One earns $10,000 a year, the other earns $100,000. They each get a raise of $10,000. So suddenly the poor person suddenly is earning $20,000 a year and the richer person is earning $110,000. The equal burden means how much should we tax that additional $10,000 so that they each experience it as an equal pain? Right, so they each experience the loss of income. They earned an extra $10,000. They each experience it as equally a sacrifice for the public good. What's the equivalent of a person who's starting at 10, gets 10,000 more? How much should we take away from that to make it the same experienced sacrifice, that is burden, as the person who starts at 100 and goes to 110? If it's a flat tax, it means that you believe, if you think that's an equal burden, it means that you think that $2,500 is worth the same to a person who already earns $100,000 as it does to a person who only earns $10,000. If you charge the same tax rate on that additional $10,000, it means you think that $2,500 has the same meaning, has the same impact on a person's life, and therefore taking it away is the same sacrifice, whether you are earning $10,000 or $100,000. So that's what the flat tax would say, that a flat tax would imply that the equal burden would be $2,500 each. The progressive tax argument says that $2,500 taken away from a person who's earning 20 might be the same as taking $7,000 or $8,000 away from a person who's already earning 100. That is, what it means to feel the pain of having your income taken away means you have to charge a higher rate. Now, how much higher? That's complicated. It's a kind of, partially it's a psychological question. You know, it's a question of how much do people actually value extra income? How much is a dollar worth at each level of income that you already have? But surely what the progressive taxation view says, to have equal burden, $2,500 for the poor person would be equal to, let's say, $5,000, twice as much. So that the tax rate for the person, the tax rate on that last $10,000 for the person who's already earning $100 should be, let's say, 50%, not 25%. Now, what 50% and 25% means then, in that case, is that those are actually equal. They're equal burdens. Those are equal burdens. They're not equal rates, but they're equal burdens. And that's what the equal burden perspective suggests, is that to have equal burden, you have to tax at ever higher rates what are called the marginal incomes of people who earn more. That extra $10,000 is called the marginal income. It's the extra income you earn given the level that you're already at. So those are our three types of taxation: poll tax, flat tax, and progressive tax. What do you think? And I'll randomly call on people unless there are hands that come up. So that, out of deference to the sensibilities of your classmates, somebody should venture a view. What do you think about these alternative tax views? So you'd all be really happy with a super steep, on fairness grounds, with a super steep progressive income tax, 70% marginal taxes at the top. Nobody has any problem with this? God, the class of 2012 is really hesitant to talk about these things. I don't bite. Yeah. So does everybody think that the flat tax is the fairest tax? Yeah.
Yeah, but like you said, the rest of the society, so the progressive tax would be the best because for more people burden based on people's income.
We have one person who feels the flat tax is the fairest, that everybody's paying the same rate. Another person is suggesting that in order to pay for the common good, the public goods, everybody maybe should have the same burden, and maybe the progressive tax is a better way of representing equal burden. Come on, yeah. So that's a modified flat tax, which says that people below the poverty line don't pay any taxes because we don't want to push people further below the poverty line. So the flat tax starts as soon as your income is above the poverty line. So let's suppose the poverty line for a family of four in the United States was $20,000 a year, just arbitrarily. That would mean that a family of four wouldn't pay any taxes for the first $20,000. Of income, and then they would pay 20% of everything they earn above that. But everybody would pay the same. Whether you earn $25,000, you'd pay 20% on that $5,000, or if you earn $20 million, you'd pay 20% on the $19,900,000, whatever, everything except the $20,000 at the bottom of that, $20 million. That's still basically a flat tax reasoning. It's just it makes an exemption at the very lowest levels. Other views, come on. Yeah. But that would be a modification. We would have a very broad flat tax between the bottom and the near top, and then have a higher rate of taxation at the very top. But that still suggests that your basic intuition is that fairness is better represented by equal percentage than by equal burden. Now that goes against, I think, the way you would regard fairness within a community that you're strongly identified with, in a family. When people do something cooperatively, the idea is that everybody should contribute the same amount of effort as they can. They should bear the same burden. Not that they should do the same percentage of their possible effort or something. You know, normally when you cooperate with people, equal burden means equal sacrifice, which an equal percentage does not mean equal sacrifice. I mean, maybe that's not clear to you, that equal percentage doesn't mean equal sacrifice. But so let me just try to say it again. If somebody is already earning 200, let's raise the numbers to make it more vivid. If somebody is already earning $200,000 and they earn another $1,000, and somebody's already earning 20 and they earn another $1,000, in terms of what it means for the quality of their life, for the problems they face, for the opportunities they have, does that $1,000 represent the same improvement in their conditions of life? I mean, does anybody think that a $1,000 is worth the same to a person who earns $200,000 as it is to a person who earns 20? So, unless you're prepared to say that it means the same thing, it's as valuable in the lives of people, then you can't support a flat tax. It's inconsistent to support a flat tax and to say, yes, I acknowledge that $1,000 is worth way less to a person who already earns $200,000 as it is to a person who earns 20. If it's worth more, it's more valuable, it means more to their lives than a person who earns $20,000, then a smaller reduction of that is the same as a bigger reduction of that last $1,000. We're talking about this last $1,000. The person who earns $200,000. Let's just kind of get a sense of your imaginary views on this. Imagine you earn $1,000 and we tax $20,000 and you earn $1,000 more and you pay a 10% tax on it. So you're paying $100 in tax, right? What's the equivalent of $100 to the person who earns already $200,000? You know, what would you think is subjectively the equivalent impact on their life of that additional $100? That's the tax being paid by the poor person. Is it $200, do you think? $300? How many think that the subjective meaning for the quality of life, for what a person can do with their life, if you already earned $200,000, the subjective meaning of the $100 for the poor person. Okay, so I'm going to ask you, let's get votes. How many think it's exactly the same? $100 is $100 no matter how much you earn. Okay, nobody thinks that. How many thinks $100 for the poor person is roughly the same as, let's say, $200 for the richer person? Okay, a couple of hands for that. How many think it's roughly the same as $300? You're going to have to raise your hand eventually, so get it in your heads. Think about when you're going to raise it. How many think it's roughly about $200? $300? 400, 500, 600. This would be nice if we could get a little distribution. 700, 800, 900. Okay, so we've got a kind of, you know, roughly speaking, just looking at the hands, I think this is what the graph looks like. So this is the, what we're graphing here is the equivalent of $100 for someone earning $20,000, and that equals how much for someone earning $200,000, right? And roughly, if this was that's the same, and this was 500, and this is 1,000. Roughly, the distribution in the class looks something like that. I think the median was around $500 or $600. What that means is that you think the burden of paying $100 in taxes, if you already earn $100 of taxes out of that next 1,000 you earn, if you are starting at 20,000, the equal burden would be having a 50% or 60% marginal tax rate at the higher level. That means that the person earning $20,000 who earns $1,000 more should pay 10%. They pay 10% on this. A person earning $200,000 plus $1,000 more, in order to get the equality, let's say, of $500, they have to pay 50% taxes on that last $100. Doesn't mean they're paying 50% taxes on all of the $200,000, just on this last $100. That would be the equal burden for those of you who raised your hand, you know, in the $400, $500, $600 range. That's what equal burden means. It means that it's the same experience sacrifice with respect to what money means to you, how much it means in your life, how much it affects your ability to do things. Money is a generalized capacity to do things in the world, and you're reducing people's capacity to do things privately in the world by taxing their personal consumption in order to pay for collective consumption. If it's collective consumption, the argument here is everybody should contribute an equal burden. And an equal burden for most of the people in the class means quite a progressive income tax. The equal burden that you were suggesting by this, you know, very quick and dirty and not very scientific reflection on what's the equivalent of $100 for the poorer person to the richer person. You, on average, people were thinking it's $100 is $400, $500, $600 for the richer person. That means the ratio of their tax rates should be roughly 10%. I set it at 10% for the poorer person. Should be roughly 40, 50, 60% on the margin, the marginal tax rate for the richer person. Now, I think when you really reflect on these matters, most often people do come to realize that equal burden is the proper way of thinking about how we should pay for the common good. The common good should be paid for by an equal burden on all people, because it is common good, not by an equal rate on all people. And the implication of that is then a progressive system. This is just an example that comes from the book. I'm not going to go through this example in detail here. I do want you to look at this carefully in the book. That explains how the tax, a progressive income tax, actually works. Because most people, even after they get educated, are really confused about this. They're really confused about just the mechanics of how, once you accept the equal burden principle, how it actually plays out, so to speak, in the arithmetic of taxation. The basic idea of this example is I take a person who earns $90,000 and we look at what their total taxes are by breaking their $90,000 into these steps. These steps are called tax brackets, and they refer to the points in the income distribution at which the marginal tax rate goes up. The marginal tax rate always being the rate on incomes earned above some level. Go through the examples carefully in the book rather than spending time here, and if you have questions, you can talk about it with your TAs. All right, that's tax fairness. And my view would be, and I, you know, this is not, some things I say are super controversial. This isn't highly controversial among people who discuss taxes philosophically and are trying to figure out what fairness means. Most people who discuss the fairness of taxes and try to really provide the moral foundations for it come up with an equal burden view. And it's a logical, not controversial, deduction from equal burden that you have to have progressive taxes. That's what equal burden produces. Tax complexity. There's a whole bunch of reasons why the tax code gets really complicated. I want to just review them because I think many of these forms of complexity are good things, not bad. And simplifying the tax code would create more problems than it would solve. So the first problem is just how do you define taxable income? This is a pretty simple, straightforward set of situations. Here are three examples. A family of five with five children versus a single adult, and they earn the same income. Should they be taxed at the same rate or not? Well, they earn the same income, but I think most people understand that if that income is being used to support five children, then it's actually not the same as income that's being used to support simply a single person. And therefore, we want to reduce the amount of taxable income of this person by some amount. Of course, that's not an easy thing to figure out how much, but just the common sense is if two people earn $100,000 a year and one has five children and one is a single person, well, you should adjust the $100,000 a year downward somewhat. So maybe you'll want to say they actually only have $75,000 of taxable income, not $100,000. Or a person with large medical expenses versus a person with no medical expenses earning the same amount of money. Do we want to tax them at the same rate? Or do we want to consider high medical expenses a deduction from your taxes so that you only pay taxes on the income above what you spent on medical expenses when the medical expenses reach some threshold? Or a person whose house is destroyed by a hurricane versus a person whose house is undamaged and they earn the same amount? Well, you could go on with the list. So this is the first kind of a complication. The notion of taxable income is different from the notion of gross income. And some adjustments, most people feel, are just simply needed for fairness purposes. That it's just too mechanical and simple-minded to say everybody who earns the same income should be taxed at the same rate because the income means different things for different people. A second kind of complexity has to do with the way taxes are policy tools to create incentives for people to do certain things in the public interest. This is the problem of what is called tax expenditures. When you approve of them, you call them a tax expenditure. When you disapprove of them, you call it a loophole. Just to give you some examples, green energy. Giving tax breaks to people to weatherize houses or for companies to invest in solar panels. So if you think it's good public policy for people to have more energy efficient houses, right? So a very good argument can be made that in the long run, the United States as a whole, everybody will be better off if we conserve energy. And we want to create incentives for people to insulate their houses, to get more efficient furnaces, and do all the other things that help to save energy. You want to create incentives for people to do it. How do you create incentives? Well, there's lots of ways you could do it. A very simple way is to say, if you spend $10,000 insulating your house, you can count half of that as a tax deduction. So $5,000 of that you don't pay taxes on. Reduces your taxable income. What that would mean is that what looks like it looks like it cost you $10,000, actually out of pocket might only end up costing you $8,000. It makes it cheaper, and therefore more people will do it. Home mortgage interest deduction. So if you think home ownership is a good thing, it helps to create stable communities, it makes people more invested in the quality of their neighborhoods, that you want to encourage people to buy their own homes, if you think that's a good thing, then allowing people to deduct mortgage interest payments is a way of funneling government revenues to help people buy homes. It's a way of supporting people buying homes. It's using the tax system to make home buying cheaper. Or take charitable contributions. If you give $10,000 to a charity and you're a high-earning person and your marginal tax rate is 35%, that's the highest rate at the moment, then you get back $3,500 in tax refunds at the end of the year for that $10,000 donation. That means the donation actually only cost you out of pocket $6,500. Now here's the magic. So this is really how you have to think about this. If I give $10,000 to a charity and get $3,500 back, the charity keeps the whole $10,000. That's exactly equivalent to me giving the charity $6,500 and the government giving the charity $3,500. That's why it's called tax expenditures. What it means is, and here's a really interesting thing to think about, it means is we're allowing individual citizens to allocate part of government spending as they wish. This is a highly decentralized way of allowing money to flow to various charities. It allows each individual to increase the amount of money their favorite charities get by putting some skin in the game. I'm going to pay $6,500. And by doing so, I get the government to kick in $3,500. Now note, that's true for all charities, including churches. The United States, through the tax system, provides enormous tax spending on religion. The idea that because of separation of church and state, the government doesn't pay a huge amount of money to support religion is just false, because all religious contributions are tax deductible. That means if I give $10,000 to a church and I'm in this higher tax bracket, I get $3,500 back. The church keeps all $10,000. It means I've given them $6,500 and everybody else through the tax system has given them $3,500. I haven't given them that $3,500. I get that back as a tax rebate. It means that the tax system is giving them the extra $3,500. It's public spending on privately designated charities. For charitable donations, you can imagine two ways that you could get government to spend taxes on charity. So here's two systems. System number one, we set up a government agency, allocate funds to that agency, institute a bureaucratic procedure for giving out grants. That's one way that the government can allocate money to various kinds of public interest charitable organizations. The National Science Foundation, the National Endowment for the Humanities, The National Endowment for the Arts do just that. The National Endowment for the Arts allocates funds. People apply to them for grants. Nonprofit arts organizations apply to the National Endowment for the Arts for grants. My daughter is in theater, and her small theater company applies to the National Endowment for the Arts for a grant to do a particular kind of production. That's one way to do it, through centralized government bureaucracy. Another way to do it is to allow tax deductions for individual contributions to nonprofit organizations. So I also give my daughter's theater company contributions, naturally. One of my favorite charities is her theater company. And I get a tax rebate for it, which means that I get to allocate part of your taxes, not just mine, your taxes, everybody's taxes. I get to allocate them to my daughter's theater company so long as I contribute as well. That's a pretty nifty way of getting money to the arts. I think it's actually not a bad way to get money to the arts. It has advantages over bureaucratic administrative machinery. You know, the bureaucratic administrative machinery means you have these grant competitions, and the arts organizations spend a huge amount of time preparing their applications, and there's always some arbitrariness in the peer review. It can get very messy as to how those grants get allocated. Well, this provides an alternative way for funds from the government to go to the arts, to go to hospitals, to go to churches, to go to all sorts of associations based on the preferences of citizens who are willing to donate their own money as well. Think of it as the government providing matching funds. Right? That's basically what it is. The government is providing matching funds to funds provided by ordinary citizens. But that's a complexity in the tax code. Right? That means the tax code's an awful lot more complicated. You have to keep track of all sorts of things. You have to have nonprofit associations, nonprofit filing statuses. People have to keep track of their deductions. All these things create what is called complexity. The government spends billions of dollars a year this way through tax expenditures. Now, I think that complexity is, broadly speaking, a combination of well-thought-out, good public policy to allow for resources to be funneled towards common purposes through a combination of government action and private action. So it's a kind of public partnership. It's a combination of that with other forms of complexity which are designed to provide cover for the privileges of advantaged groups. And this brings us to the third kind of complexity issue. The problem of loopholes. Actually, I skipped one little point. Let me just make this side point. This is not the main action for this part of the discussion. There is a problem with the charitable donations model that we have, which is the richer you are, the more you are in a position to vote for the government spending on the things you like. So if you just think of it, whenever a wealthy person donates $1 million to the opera, so to speak, the government kicks in $350,000 of funding for the opera through tax expenditures because it's a charitable donation. That means that the wealthy get to determine the kind of arts that are around and available in the public more than average citizens do because they have more money to donate. There is an alternative model besides allowing tax deductions, which is what's called a non-refundable tax credit targeted for certain purposes. We could have a system in which every taxpayer is given, let's say, $1,000 of non-refundable tax credit to allocate to charitable donations. So they can still allocate them however they want. It's still decentralized, allows every citizen who pays taxes to allocate part of tax money to charities. But it's not proportionate to how rich you are. Everybody gets the same vote for allocating public monies to private purposes. to charitable purposes. That's an alternative model. It's not one that has much traction. But the third type of complexity has to do with deductions that reduce the fairness of taxation. And this is the problem of loopholes. When you allow tax deductions to undermine the fairness principle of equal burden, then the deductions become suspect. Corporations can count as business expenses all sorts of things which are really disguised forms of consumption for executives. You allow executives to have access to private jets, company cars, corporate meetings in Hawaii resorts, in which the amount of time spent in the meeting at the corporate meeting at the resort is a few hours and the rest of the time is fun and recreation. And you call that a business expense, and therefore it's deductible. The use of the home mortgage deduction, which allows for a wealthy person to get a much bigger tax break than a poor person from their mortgages, because it's simply a home interest deduction. The example given here is if a person with $1 million mortgage on an expensive home and $10,000 a month interest and a marginal rate of 35%, they save $3,500 a month, or $42,000 a year. That is, the government is paying them $42,000 a year in order to enable them to buy a $1 million home. A working class person who buys a home for $100,000 with $1,000 a month interest payment and only a 15% marginal rate only gets $1,800 a year. So that's a question. Is that fair that because you're rich, the government is spending out of taxes $43,000 a year to help you buy a house, whereas if you're working class, the government is only spending $1,800 a year to help you buy a house? The rich are getting 23 times more government support for their purchases. Well, that's the consequence of this way of supporting housing coming in the form of a tax deduction on mortgage interest. That's why many people feel the mortgage interest deduction is actually a pretty unfair public policy. So even if we think it's a good thing for people to own houses, this is a bad way of supporting that idea, because it helps the affluent much more than it helps ordinary people. Furthermore, if you compare the amount of money being spent on supporting housing through the mortgage interest than is supporting renters or public housing, it's clear that the way in which the tax code is being used for this particular purpose undermines the fairness of the tax system as a whole. So complexity is complex. Part of complexity is a way of deepening the fairness of the tax system, of saying, yes, not all income should be treated the same. People are in different circumstances. We want to create deductions that take that into account. Part of the complexity comes from good public policy wanting to encourage things like energy efficiency. Energy efficiency is a good thing. It's a public policy. It's something we would want to encourage. And the most efficient and cost-effective way of encouraging weatherization and energy efficiency is probably to do it through the tax code. That's a good way of doing it. But complexity can also be a cover for unfairness, and can indeed make the unfairness of the tax code even worse. The fact that this was well publicized during the election campaign, the fact that because of various kinds of tax deductions and overseas transfers of tax fund of income and so on, that Mitt Romney paid only 13.9%, I think, taxes overall on his $20 million income, many people felt was grossly unfair, that he paid a lower percentage of his income in taxes than did his secretary. And that was entirely because of the complexities of the tax code. On balance, probably it's the case in the American context that more complexity contributes to unfairness than to good public policy, but that's a very tough thing to sort out, precisely because these categories overlap and they serve many different purposes. I guess I've run out of time before the last part of this lecture, which is about myths and realities of taxes in the United States. I think what we will do, got 2 minutes, you can just calmly wait till I'm finished. I think what we'll do is I'll finish up this at the beginning of the next lecture and still have time to deal with the material on, I believe, the media is the next session. Okay, see you on Thursday.